WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. That beautiful piano playing is courtesy of one Jorge Federico Osorio. It is with the greatest of pleasure that Carthage College is welcoming Mr. Osorio to campus to play a recital Tuesday evening, the 26th of March, 7:30 p.m. in Siebert Chapel as part of Carthage's Piano Festival, which involves a whole host of different events. Mr. Osorio is a spectacularly gifted concert pianist who has performed all over the world, a wide range of repertoire with many of the world's very, very finest orchestras. And he is a prolific recording artist as well, a lover of chamber music, and also a very gifted and admired teacher, now on the music faculty at Roosevelt University's Chicago College of Performing Arts. And I'm glad that he has made a few moments in his schedule available for this conversation on the morning show. Jorge Federico Osorio, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. I'm so delighted to be here with you.
It's going to be great to hear you Tuesday evening. And our director of piano studies at Carthage, Dr. Wael Farouk, speaks so glowingly of you and of your playing. And he, of course, himself is a masterful concert pianist. So when he is in awe of the gifts of somebody, that really means something. I know you know Dr. Farouk very well.
I know him very well, and I'm so happy. And when he contacted me to invite me to give this recital, that I do it with the greatest pleasure.
I would love to know a little bit about where you come from originally, and in particular about your first study of the piano, which I understand began mm-hmm. at the tender age of 5 with your mother. So tell us, first
exactly.
of all, go ahead.
Yes, I started actually in music. I started with a violin, and shortly after that, I took on the piano and studied both instruments till I was about 12 years old. And I had a teacher for the violin, although my father was a violinist as well, but his music was his passion as well. And, of course, I studied with my mother until I left to continue my studies in Paris when I was 16. So music, we heard music all day at home, and, of course, that make a tremendous impression on me. But it's not that I wanted to be a pianist at that age. I just love music, and that's really what continues with me, is the music itself. Of course, I'm fortunate enough to be a pianist, and we have this wealth of repertoire that it's something unique.
What was it like to study piano with your mother? We sometimes hear of that working out beautifully, and other cases in which that can be a little bit tricky. It sounds like it worked out very well for the two of you.
Well, it worked out very well. My mother, fortunately, she's still alive. She was going to be 96, and she was 94. Actually, we played a Mozart double piano concerto 2 years ago with the orchestra in Mexico City. And, she's a beautiful pianist, and also she was a wonderful teacher. I mean, one of the best teachers in Mexico. And her influence was, so important for so many people. Mm. And the interesting thing with her is that I remember studying with her, but, when I was very young, what I would do coming back from school immediately is just maybe practice with her, for about half an hour, 45 minutes, and then a little bit more in the afternoon, and that was it. I think she knew how to guide me quite well. And then when I decided I really wanted to be a concert pianist, I wanted to focus more on the piano when I was about 12-13, then I started studying more seriously.
What was it that that inspired your move to Paris to continue your studies? What was it about Paris that was so intriguing for you?
It was Paris, but it was mainly that I met this teacher in Mexico. His name is Bernard Flavigny. He studied with Cortot when he was young, and a tremendous pianist. And he came to Mexico regularly to give master classes. So I met him there in Mexico, and I really just wanted to continue my studies with him in Paris. So I went there and I stayed in one year at the Paris Conservatory. But I continued privately studying with him.
In all of these years, did your interest in the piano ever waver? Did you ever find yourself, for instance, distracted by other possibilities or just tired of it? Or by and large, has this been a steady, relentless love?
That's exactly what it is. The only thing that I regretted is that I gave up the violin completely because I so much enjoyed it. I mean, I used to be an outside reader in the violin, so I wonder why did I was so drastic and abandoned the instrument. That's my only regret, really.
What has the life of a professional concert pianist been like for you compared to what your expectations were? I mean, has this life, in fact, been what you expected and wanted it to be?
I would think so, yes. Although, it's like, I mean, like growing up in Mexico, and then I would listen to these wonderful recordings my parents had about the recordings of Horowitz, of Gilev playing which symphony and things like that, and just dreaming that one day I would love to play with such an orchestra. And you know, all that has happened, so you never know. So it's been so rewarding and so wonderful. It's not that it is an easy career, it's very competitive, but I mean, I think I've achieved many, many of the things that I wanted. And it's really the love of music and the love of music making and playing everywhere that it's so wonderful and so rewarding.
When I survey your recordings, it appears that you have a wide-ranging love of the piano repertoire. That is, I look and look in vain for anything that might not be of interest to you. It appears that you love just about every kind of music for the piano. I mean, from all of the great periods, from all of the great composers. Are there particular composers or particular works with which you feel special affinity?
Well, yeah, certainly. Affinity, I think composers like Beethoven, Brahms, and Mozart are going to be with me always. But of course, the music of Chopin and Debussy, Prokofiev, I mean, there's a wealth of repertoire still that to be discovered. But certainly from very, very early age, it was Beethoven and Brahms.
I know that you have taken special pains to champion the music of several Mexican composers, including
yes.
Manuel M. Ponce, but others as well, who and some of these are names that are not particularly familiar to me, but I'm sure it is important to you that their music be heard and appreciated.
Absolutely. And first of all, because it's beautiful music. And, I mean, particularly I started with Manuel M. Ponce because, I mean, one of the main composers. And he was a beautiful pianist. He started with Martin Krauss for a while in Berlin as well. And fortunately or unfortunately, everybody knew about Manuel M. Ponce because of the recording of Heifetz playing Estrellita. But, I mean... I think there's much more than just one beautiful song. There's fantastic studies for pianos, mazurkas. I mean, there's so many things to discover. And at this moment, actually, I'm preparing a very romantic concerto by the composer Ricardo Castro. And this piano concerto, I believe, could be the very first concerto written in the Americas. So it's interesting, and it's a fabulous work.
Wonderful. What is it like to perform not in the concert hall for an audience, but to perform in the recording studio? I know more about singers. I'm from the world of voice, and I know that for many professional singers, they can, not all, but many find the sort of the artificial confines of a recording situation in a studio to be very confining and sometimes even a bit crippling artistically. But clearly, you do not find it so. You seem to incredibly comfortable and free-flowing as you make your recordings. Can you tell us about the satisfaction that recording gives you?
Yeah, well, incredibly at ease. I wouldn't call it like that. But I think it's also a state of mind. Of course, when you go and record somewhere, I've recorded in many places, in concert halls, in churches, in very cold churches in England, I remember, or studios. I think it's what you want to convey in your state of mind as to not to let anything bother you to achieve what you really want to do musically. I think that's the important thing.
When you come to a new place like Carthage's Siebert Chapel, where you will be performing Tuesday night, what is typically the process like by which you grow comfortable with the hall and especially with the instrument that you will be playing? What kind of an experience is that typically like?
Yes, coming to a new hall and to a new piano, well, that's the life of being a pianist. But sometimes, you know, you get to a new instrument and you can get acquainted with instruments very quickly. And that is something that I wouldn't say it's automatic, but you have to be, I don't say you have to be trained for that, but I mean, you somehow you get the knack of it. Sometimes you come to places and you don't have the time to try the piano, and you have to be ready for that as well. The important, I think, is to think about that's the main thing.
I'm sure it is a comfort to you when you sit down at a unfamiliar piano and see the name Steinway. As a Steinway artist, I know you are appreciative of the beautiful instruments that they create, and of course it will be a Steinway that you'll be playing Tuesday night at Carthage.
Absolutely, I'm looking forward so much to that. So it's every concert, it's a new thing and it's an adventure, and that's what it's so important to me, to keep the moment fresh, spontaneous, and make the music live, especially for that moment.
We're speaking with Jorge Federico Osorio. He is performing at Carthage College Tuesday evening at 7:30 in Siebert Chapel. You will be playing Tuesday night the music of Haydn and Schubert and Beethoven. I wonder if you would say a quick word about each of these three works that will be played on Tuesday's program.
Well, in a way, they're like late sonatas of the composers. If you can consider that it's a late Schubert, I mean, he was so young when he died. But it also, I think, of making like following the keys, the C major sonata of Haydn. It's so beautiful, so spontaneous, so fresh, and then following for this wonderful A major and haunting sonata, this Schubert sonata, and finishing with the Opus 111, which is one of the most incredible things that has been written for the piano, I believe. This arietta, the way he finishes with the trills and the variations, is just it's overwhelming every time.
Before we let you go, I wonder if you would say a quick word about the pleasure and satisfaction that you derive from teaching.
Yes, a lot of satisfaction. And it's really, teaching is like discovering things for yourself all the time. Sometimes it's wonderful when you can discover or rediscover from the repertoire that you're teaching. And it's very satisfactory when you feel that you can guide someone to be more curious, to deepen the understanding, which in many ways it helps you to do the same thing.
Well, we are excited about you coming to Carthage to share your mastery with us. Again, your recital is Tuesday evening, 7:30 in Siebert Chapel, and this is part of Carthage's 2019 Lakeside Piano Festival, which involve a number of different events throughout the week, all of which are free and open to the public. There are tickets required for the guest recital of Jorge Federico Osorio. And if you would like a ticket for the guest recital Tuesday evening, you should go to www.carthage.edu/tickets, or you can call the Fine Arts box office at 262-551-6661. And you can arrange for your ticket to attend Tuesday evening's recital by Jorge Federico Osorio. Mr. Osorio, what a great pleasure for me to speak with you. And I wish you safe travels to Carthage and much pleasure in the years ahead as you continue to play and teach. And thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you. Thank you for the interview, and it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
And here are a few moments from the end of the first movement of the Brahms Second Piano Concerto with Mr. Osorio at the keyboard. The time is 8:33, and you are listening to The Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and part two of our program today will be coming up in just a moment. Before we get to part two of today's program, we want to remind you that The Morning Show is now available as a podcast. You can go to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Google Podcasts and subscribe, and The Morning Show comes to you. And if that is a more convenient way for you to hear the program and or revisit interviews you've enjoyed in the past or interviews that you have missed, then please consider subscribing to The Morning Show podcast. You should seek it out as WGTD's Morning Show with Greg Berg. That's how it is listed, and that's how you can subscribe. 8:36 and time for part two of today's program here on WGTD. For the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show, we probe into one of the most important and influential and intriguing figures in all of world history, and yet someone who most of us actually know very, very little about, and probably most of the assumptions we make about this man are based on myth, superstition, and serious misunderstanding. We are going to be talking today about Napoleon, and the reason for our conversation today is the publication of what promises to be the definitive biography of this important figure, a book called Napoleon, A Life, in which we are exposed to Napoleon, who he was, and how he influenced the world in which he lived, and also the way in which he has been so seriously misunderstood ever since. And Andrew Roberts has done a superb job with this marvelous book, and in a sense, it is no surprise. He is a best-selling author of a number of highly regarded books, including The Storm of War, Masters and Commanders, and others, and has done a great deal of work on various historical documentaries, and for many, many years has been interested in Napoleon, collected much memorabilia related to him, visited many of the battle sites and important archives in Europe where much of the information shared in this new book resides, but has never really been disseminated to the public before. Again, the book is Napoleon, A Life. And Andrew Roberts, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much indeed, Greg. It's a delight to be on.
So, in a sense, this is maybe a pointless question, but I am curious to know why you have been so interested in Napoleon for so long. I mean, not that it's surprising that anyone should be interested in him. There's all kinds of reasons to be interested, but did anything in particular sort of prick your finger the first time and send you on this, what ultimately has been quite a long journey of discovery for you?
Yes. In fact, there was a moment, but it was back in 1973 when my late mother gave me a biography of Napoleon when I was 10 years old, and I read it and loved it, and I've been fascinated by him ever since. It's actually, I've gone back to the book. It's not a terribly good book, in fact, but nonetheless, it was enough to spark the interest of a 10-year-old and keep me really fascinated ever since.
You say something in the introduction to the book that I really have to ask you about. In talking about how much Napoleon has been discussed over the generations, even if the result has been a serious misunderstanding of him. At one point you write, more books have been written with the name Napoleon in the title than there have been days since his death in 1821. I'm trying to decide if that can possibly be literally true. I think...
It is literally true. Yes, and on top of the many tens of thousands of books written with Napoleon in the title, there have been 3,500 biographies of him. So really what makes mine different, I believe, is that, well, first of all, it's the first cradle-to-the-grave single-volume biography in English to be published since the publication between 2004 and the present day of the 33,000 letters that Napoleon signed during his life. They've been published by the Fondation Napoleon in Paris, a very scholarly institute, and I'm the first historian to be able to write a book on the back of them.
You tell us that among many of these previous books that have been written, that in many cases, if they drew upon correspondence, it was correspondence that had been culled by Napoleon III, and evidently correspondence which was rather seriously mishandled or distorted for the sake of maybe nothing more than simple propaganda. Tell us what has been done in the past, because I think it helps us appreciate then the clarity and truthfulness of what you've done in this new biography.
Yes, some pretty terrible things were done with the correspondence of Napoleon. His, as you mentioned, his nephew, the Emperor Napoleon III, cut out anything that that put Napoleon in a bad light. It turned out that many of the letters, certainly the sexual letters, he wrote letters of a very erotic nature to his wife Josephine. Those were all the sort of erotic parts were all cut out, and much worse than that, some false letters that Napoleon never read were inserted into the correspondence, which we now can you know expunge and get rid of, and not take into consideration. So it does require this new set of correspondence, which is unbelievably scholarly, beautifully footnoted, and wonderfully presented. Entirely does change our view of the great man.
Hmm. And in your view, he really was a great man. In fact, one of the central points of your book, to which you return again and again, is the fact that so much of what we take for granted in the modern civilized world, particularly some of the ideas by which many nations govern themselves and sort of handle matters of society and culture, can be traced back to Napoleon. And if he didn't create such ideas, he in many cases really helped expand them or make them more of an intricate part of life. Tell us some of those ideas to which we really owe a debt of gratitude to Napoleon.
Yes, well, of course, Americans had, before the French Revolution, had already had their revolution. So you did have your constitution, an extraordinary document of the Enlightenment. But that wasn't the case in Prussia and Austria and Russia and France at the time of the Ancien Régime. So when the French Revolution burst into the world and set up a series of ideals it wasn't able to keep up to, as the guillotine showed so monstrously fairly soon afterwards. Nonetheless, Napoleon was the person who managed to keep the best ideas of the French Revolution: religious toleration, the abolition of feudalism, equality before the law, these kind of concepts, meritocracy, ideas by which all modern, successful modern civilized nations live by today. And he extended them geographically, he codified them, and he protected them, so that when the Bourbons came back to power after his fall, after the Battle of Waterloo, they were not able to put that France back onto the old Ancien Régime. And so as a result, these ideas took root in Europe and managed to extend themselves.
Hmm. We're speaking with Andrew Roberts about his newest book, which is called Napoleon, A Life. Much of what you write in this book helps us cast away some of the ideas which have been in place for so long. I mean, they're practically calcified. And one of them, of course, is that when most of us think of Napoleon, we think of him as, in your words, the quintessential warmonger. When, in fact, you tell us war was declared on him far more than he was declaring war on others. Help us understand how such a thing can possibly be true, because it feels so wrong or so contrary to what most of us have been told about Napoleon over the years.
Well, that's right. That's right. As you say, it has. That's a good phrase. It has calcified. But the fact is, just because they're called the Napoleonic Wars, it doesn't mean he was responsible for them all. He was responsible for an appallingly opportunistic attack on Spain and Portugal in 1807 and 1808, which went disastrously wrong for him. He was also, of course, responsible for the 1812 campaign against Russia, which broke his army and effectively led to his downfall. But He was not responsible for either of the two wars of the coalitions that started when he was only an artillery lieutenant after the French Revolution. Those were attempts by the Austrians and the Prussians to crush the French Revolution, strangle it in its cradle. He can't be blamed for those. Neither can he be blamed for the subsequent five wars of the coalitions. There were in all seven coalition wars, which were all declared against him, rather than him declaring them on anyone else. And he also tried to make peace in each of those five wars. The fact was, though, that he was a great military leader and a great general who knew that in his 60 battles he won 46 of them and drew seven of them. So he didn't shrink away from an attack when it was made on him. But nonetheless, he cannot be blamed for all of the wars of the Napoleonic Wars.
To what extent was Napoleon revolutionary in his military thinking or in the way that he led troops into battle? Did he operate by the sort of the standard practices of the day, but just do it very well? Or were there ways in which he was really, in a sense, an original thinker or innovator in this respect?
It was a little bit of both. After France's defeat in the Spanish War of the Seven Years' War in 1763, a lot of French thinkers, military thinkers, came up with some great ideas for how armies could be modernized. The best idea being the corps system. So instead of having huge amounts of infantry, cavalry, and artillery all separate, you created mini armies, corps, which had a few infantry, cavalry, and artillery in them, and they were able, therefore, to maneuver separately and to get to battlefields in such a way that they could outmaneuver the enemy and go around the flanks and so on. And Napoleon, although he didn't invent that concept, was the first person to perfect it and to unleash it on an unsuspecting Europe. By 1812, all the other countries in Europe had adopted it. And, of course, it stayed in the military lexicon until 1945. So he was somebody who didn't originally come up with the idea, but he used it. And he also, through things like speeding up the armies. In the old days, people would stop and besiege cities. He didn't do that. He concentrated on the enemy army, tried to destroy it in the field, and realized that the city would fall afterwards if he had managed to achieve that. So in that sense, he was an innovator as well.
Hmm. You write at one point, Napoleon represented the Enlightenment on horseback. What do you mean by that phrase?
Well, I very much mean the ideas that he took from Rousseau and Voltaire and the other Enlightenment thinkers. These ideas of, as I mentioned earlier, meritocracy and equality before the law, which you didn't see in many of the European states at the time. When he went into, for example, Italy and Germany, one of the first things he would do would be to liberate the Jews. He would let them out of their ghettos. He would stop them wearing the yellow star. He would allow them to have civil and religious liberty. And he would, in places like Malta, for example, stop them from being sold into slavery and allow them to build synagogues for the first time. Now, that is Enlightenment thinking. But it wouldn't have been able to have happened unless he had been on horseback, unless his armies had been successful in the field. So the abolition of the Spanish Inquisition, for example, in Spain, was an integral part of what he was trying to do for Europe.
Hmm. Among the notable events in Napoleon's career was his decision to invade Russia, which you caution us to say was not in and of itself his worst mistake or most foolish mistake. For however disastrous it ultimately turned out to be, there were reasons why he did that. Say a word about this really critical moment in Napoleon's life and career.
Yes. The invasion of Russia in 1812 has been totally misunderstood. It's always been seen by historians as an example of the Napoleon complex. Now, I don't believe Napoleon had a Napoleon complex. I don't believe that one can see hubris leading to nemesis in that classic ancient Greek dramatic trope. In fact, he had perfectly rational, logical reasons to invade Russia. He didn't want to go as far as Moscow. He just wanted to fight a battle on the borders of Moscow, but got sucked further in. But nonetheless, he had an army twice the size of the Russians. He had defeated the Russians twice before. He had no idea that that typhus was going to destroy so many of his men. It was a disease that wasn't even diagnosed until 1911, nearly 100 years later. And he had no idea that the Russians were going to have this scorched earth policy by which they actually burnt down two-thirds of their own co-capital, Moscow. So so many of these assumptions made about Napoleon, that he almost went mad with power and became a sort of almost a lunatic at the end of his career, are completely wrong. In fact, he had plans to stop earlier at Vitebsk and Smolensk, which of course he should have done. And he also allowed enough time to get from Moscow to Smolensk, even more time than he had taken getting from Smolensk to Moscow. So the idea that he didn't know that Russia had a bad winter is also an absurdity. No, the major problem came when he took a decision, one of many thousands that he took, of course, as a soldier, after the Battle of Maloyaroslavets in October 1812, to go north rather than to go west. And he took that decision. It was turned out to be a disastrous one, and it led to the horrors, the cannibalism, and all the rest of the retreat from Moscow.
Hmm. It's so intriguing, isn't it, that when we think of Napoleon, we immediately think of Waterloo. And of course, we can think of probably a lot of important figures in history whose careers ended with some kind of catastrophic reversal, but it might not be a name that resonates the way the name Waterloo resonates, and it really colors our perception of who he was.
That's right, yes. He most definitely did meet his Waterloo on the 18th of June 1815. And it was a very strange battle, really, in that he broke all of his military maxims, all of the rules by which he had done so well up until then. And only the previous year, in 1814, he had won four victories in 5 days. But at Waterloo, it all collapsed. And part of it was, as I say, not just that he was absolutely against one of the greatest, if not the greatest, British general in the Duke of Wellington, but also because he split his army just before the battle, which was a disastrous thing to do. He didn't know where the Prussians were. His intelligence failed him. He started the battle far too late. It was a series of mistakes that that all go against his own military maxims.
Mm. We have to hurry through two last questions, and I regret that because they're two very interesting matters. One of them is Napoleon and Josephine, and one of the most important things your book does is to sort of recast that relationship, which in your view was in no way a Romeo and Juliet relationship.
It really wasn't. She was unfaithful to him within weeks of the marriage. And he found out 2 years later when he was in the desert outside Cairo. And at that point, he embarked on the first of what I've identified as 22 love affairs with various mistresses. So no, it certainly wasn't Romeo and Juliet. However, they did actually for 10 years have a happy happy relationship. They got on well. It's a far more complex, far more human, far more interesting story than the classic Romeo and Juliet one.
You have already mentioned the 33,000 signed letters of Napoleon, which you have utilized in crafting this biography. In what way do these letters let us into kind of the inner chambers of Napoleon's soul and heart? I mean, how personal are these letters?
No, it's a very good question. They're immensely personal, all of them. As I say, he signed all of them. They're to his closest confidants, his friends, his mistresses, his wives, his palace officials, his marshals and generals, of course, and his ministers. And they show the passion of the man, a deeply passionate individual, one who could write. He had the most beautiful written style. But also a man who could compartmentalize his life and his mind to such a degree that when he's moving armies across Europe, he's also writing to the prefect of Genoa to tell him to stop taking his mistress to the opera. Or when, just before the Battle of Borodino, he is this huge battle is about to start, he's sitting down the night before and writing the rules and regulations of the Comédie Française. Back in Paris, this is an astonishing account. When the Kremlin is almost burnt down in 1812, and he returns to Moscow and goes back into the Kremlin, which has just been saved from being burnt down, he then actually writes the rules of a girls' school at Saint-Denis outside Paris that he wants to build. I mean, this is an extraordinary mind, a capacity for. The multitasking, which is truly astonishing.
He's an astonishing figure in many ways. At one point you write, Napoleon convinced his followers they were taking part in an adventure, a pageant, an experiment, and a story whose sheer splendor would draw the attention of posterity for centuries. He was able to impart to ordinary people the sense that their lives, and if necessary their deaths in battle, mattered in the context of great events. They too could make history. The book again is called Napoleon, A Life, and the author, Andrew Roberts. Andrew Roberts, congratulations. You must be so justifiably proud of this accomplishment, and I'm so glad we got to talk today on the morning show about your marvelous book. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Greg. I really appreciate it. Great honor.
Tomorrow on the morning show, you'll hear my interview with Max Clau. He is someone who has studied for a number of years the whole matter of social change. How does society change, come to act differently, feel differently about important topics and issues? And in particular, how does society come to a different understanding of race and racial justice? His very intriguing book is titled Race and Social Change, A Quest, A Study, A Call to Action. Our interview will be airing on tomorrow's morning show. On Monday, we'll be hearing from two members of the Board of Directors of the Friends of the Museum, the Kenosha Public Museum, Miles Hartley and Vicki Steger, talking about a big event that is coming up next weekend, namely Wizardpalooza, which is designed for Harry Potter fans, young and old alike. We'll also be hearing from two representatives of the National Geographic Society about the latest book in their Young Readers series called Falcon's Feather. On Tuesday, we will hear more about next week's Lakeside Piano Festival at Carthage College. We'll talk to Dr. Wael Farouk, who is head of piano studies at Carthage, and he will be one of the very busy pianists part of next week's events, which include the Tuesday night a recital given by Jorge Federic Osorio, my guest for part one of today's morning show. Next Wednesday, we're going to begin a three-day series on baseball interviews. We'll begin on Wednesday with an interview with S.L. Price and a book called Heart of the Game, one of my all-time favorite books about a baseball player who played in the minor leagues for the most part and only very briefly in the major leagues. So it's mostly a look at life in the minor leagues. And this player's career ended by him being killed in an on-field accident. But it is an inspiring story. On Thursday, I'm going to replay my interview with Ransom Jackson, an early major leaguer who played in the time of Jackie Robinson. He just died yesterday.